And I'm particularly interested in the where we are going. So, Robert, if you can really answer that in an hour or less, you are my hero. Before you get going, I think we have some informational stuff from staff.
Thank you, Chair. In your packets is an article that's not part of Bob's presentation. It's from the New York Times. It's on health reimbursement arrangements that were discussed several weeks ago, and it's just in your packets for informational only, so be aware of that. Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Robert, enter and sign in, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Robert Nickel, and I'm Manager of Community Services for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is part of the Department of Human Services. I was afraid that I would be taken up on the last phrase of my title, subtitle. Where we're going is certainly...
Can we cut through this other stuff here and get to that? Because we need answers, okay?
Probably my best comeback would be to say, to figure out where we're going, we probably should figure out where we've been and where we're at now so that we have some historical information to guide us a little bit, because I agree we're at, I think, what I consider to be a very critical crossroads in mental health and addiction services in the state of Oregon. I always like to start off these kinds of presentations with a quick introduction, which is a quotation from Gerald Grob in a book that was published almost 10 years ago now called The Mad Among Us, A History of the Care of America's Mentally Ill. He's a Rutgers University professor of history. The inescapable presence of the mentally ill has always raised important questions or issues. What is society's obligation to them? What is the most effective way of meeting their varied needs? And should the protection needs take precedence over the human needs of the mentally ill? And in many ways, that sums up what Oregon has been struggling with really since 1843. Many of you may be aware that in 1843, the provisional government had as one of its topics the issue of what to do about, I think there were about five mentally ill people that were in Oregon territory at that time, and they really didn't have answers for what to do with them. These were five people that the families had really been unable to handle any further. So there was a set of laws adopted at that point, and $500 was initially appropriated to defray expenses for caring for these folks. In those days, probate courts were directed to determine the disposition of such persons. They used a jury of 12 intelligent and impartial men. A number of women in audiences usually scoff at that particular artifact of history, but there it is.
And speaking of women, Ms. King, could I ask you to drink your soda pop a little less noisily, please? Thank you.
You missed that sexual harassment orientation, did you?
No, that's a request for the efficiency of the committee. I mean, you know, this sip, sip, sip thing all day long. Go ahead, sir.
If a jury of 12 intelligent and impartial men decided the person was insane, then a trio of guardians was appointed. Can you imagine? We serve 110,000 people in mental health services per year now. That would, if they were all insane, according to law, which they're of course not, but if they were, it would take a tenth of the population to look after them. The county was responsible for paying for the cost of care. Now, the county and state tensions, which we often bump into as we talk about these issues, started very early on. In 1855, the counties made their first appeal for territorial funds to serve the people who were in their communities. And in 1856, the territorial government revoked the funds. One of the things that I've learned in studying the history of mental health in Oregon is that there's nothing really new under the sun.
Hey, wasn't a state. We're not a state yet, okay?
But that marked the beginning of the counties being the backbone of public mental health services in Oregon. And, of course, tensions continue to the present time between the state and the county in terms of who should take primary responsibility for the care of people. The next slide shows the growth in state institutional population. Of course, the first 100 years or more is primarily a state institutional approach to the mentally ill. In 1862, when we opened the first facility, there were 12. The next year, it had already jumped to 83, or to 28. 77, and 3 years later, and you can see the pattern. And in 1877, of note is that mental health took 52% of the state budget.
Did that include the
territorial budget? I'm sorry.
That include the legislative share?
Chair Westland and Representative March, no, I'm not sure exactly what that,
wait,
that
can
was.
Can you back that up again? That's an amazing slide.
Can you back it up?
Well, hell, I didn't mean to make you go through all that. Mental health share of Oregon's 1877. It is the state budget.
It is a state budget.
Yeah. That's right.
52%. Go tell that to K-12.
That's why I figured I had to include the legislature's budget.
I think it says several things. One is that government in those days was much, much smaller. And this was, of course, a large social problem. And even in those days, hospital care was an expensive feature. There were tensions at the very beginning of the institutions that care cost too much. There were audits of Dr. Hawthorne and questions about whether he was charging too much for the care of the patients that the state had entrusted to him in the 1860s. So, okay. Now, I thought it would be interesting to show you historically, 150 years ago, what the leading state in the country looked like in terms of where people actually lived who had mental illnesses. And what struck me in looking at this study was that even in those days, maybe not the majority, but a large, large minority of people still lived with their families or in the community. That's that kind of purple, bluish-purple bar. The second largest group of people lived in hospitals or supervised care. Of particular interest, since the role of county jails and prisons in the care of the mentally ill seems like a huge problem now, and I believe that it is, that's not a new problem either. There was a large chunk of people with mental illnesses who ended up in jails and prisons in those days. This was a study that was done by a Dr. Jarvis, and he did a complete survey of all the persons identified as mentally ill in the state of Massachusetts at that time. So there was a clear pattern. Let's go on to the next slide. Here's what Oregon looks like in the past year. We've budgeted about 25% of the total funds for the state hospitals, and 75% has been in the community. That ratio has changed considerably even over the last 12 or 15 years. I believe when I came to work at the State Mental Health Division 12 years ago, it was roughly 50-50. So we've made a tremendous investment in community resources. There's much more reliance now, obviously, on families and independent living. Homelessness was something that was probably at an issue in 1854, but we actually have a count of it that we did in, I think, 2001. And we estimate that there were about 1,000... I'm having trouble reading my own script there. A little over 1,000 people with mental illnesses who were homeless.
1,500.
1,500, is that what it says? Thank you. Yeah. So there's actually, it's interesting to note that there's probably slightly more homeless mentally ill people than there are people in jails, and quite a few more homeless than are in our hospitals. The hospitals include our state hospitals, our acute care hospitals, and all of our our residential beds for adults. Okay. Go on to the next slide. This is just another slide that compares the two states in 150 years apart. Okay, what I want to move into now is some discussion of a report, a government report that people have actually paid attention to. It was the 1988 Governor's Commission on Inpatient Psychiatric Services. And this was Governor Goldschmidt's effort to move forward in the care of people with serious and persistent mental illnesses. Governor Goldschmidt established the committee, I believe, in 1987, and he had six major tasks that he wanted them to address. One was to establish long-range planning and budgeting. Another was to enhance state hospital programs. There was a sense that the state hospital programs were in crisis and that the quality of care was not adequate. Another goal was to establish local acute inpatient programs. Fourth goal was to increase the range of community services. A fifth goal was to add 168 beds for forensic patients by 1995. And finally, to reconstruct and remodel the state hospital facilities. Next slide shows the predicted measurable benefits that were expected to be gained from this, so that all state hospital units were to be accredited to make federal funds more available. We were to increase state hospital staffing to reduce injuries to patients and staff. In 1984, we had closed both state hospitals to voluntary admission. So the only way you could get a psychiatric inpatient bed at public expense was to be forced in there by the courts to go in under a hold or a civil commitment or a criminal court commitment.
Now, Bob, federal funds aren't available for forensic populations, are they?
Federal funds, Chair Westland, are generally unavailable for people in state institutions if they're between the ages of 22 and 64. So the fact that they're criminally committed or civilly committed and residing in a state hospital would preclude the use of federal funds in those programs. We do have federal funds in the children and adolescent treatment programs and in the geropsychiatric programs. And we have a waiver to provide some Medicaid-funded services for people staying less than 30 days at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center. But generally, you're correct.
Well, and the reason I was asking is all state hospital units, and I'm going, hey, we got the forensic unit residing in a state hospital, I'm going to be accredited to make federal funds available. I'm wondering if there's something we are not doing that would allow federal funds to flow to a forensic population.
Chair Westland, I think the goal at that time was to get federal funds where you could get them in, and I don't think there was ever an effort to get them for the forensic units or for the adult civil
right.
commitment units.
I just saw that. Hey, wait a minute. I wonder if that's a vein we could mine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I was going to save this for later, but since you mentioned the children mental health programs, I was going to ask if Oregon was taking advantage of or planning to take advantage of the TEFRA Medicaid option, also known as the Katie Beckett option.
Okay. Chair Westland, Representative March, we did look into that about a year ago, and the response we got back from the federal government was not encouraging. In order to do the Katie Beckett amendment, we would have had to open up the eligibility pool so broad that it would have created many other financial problems for the state. So at that time, we decided to back away from pursuing that.
Okay, thank you.
For the benefit of Representative Greenlick, could you say what the Katie Beckett or TEFRA amendment would be?
Chair Westland, I'm not sure I can explain all the technicalities of it, other than if we had a Katie Beckett amendment, it would allow a lot of kids to become eligible for Medicaid that currently they live with families whose income is too high. And I couldn't even tell you what TEFRA stands for. But
it actually stands for the Tax Equity and Financial Responsibility Act of 1982.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with this mostly. This was just a little...
Right, it was just a small piece of it. Thanks.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We know, or we think we know, that civilly committed patients in units of less than 16 or 16 less beds do receive Medicaid match. Do you know when that program came in and what the policy behind that program was? Was it trying to get them back to the community, or what was the plan?
Chair Westland and Representative Bates, the history of the federal lack of willingness to fund mental health services really goes back to the 1850s when President Franklin Pierce vetoed a bill that had passed both houses of Congress at that time, which would have set up a land grant, federal land grant kind of system to allow the funding of state hospitals in the various states. And from that moment on, the federal government has essentially stayed out of the funding of anything that resembles a state hospital. A number of years ago, there was an allowance made for Medicaid funding could be made available to facilities if they served 16 or fewer patients. And so, in fact, we've taken considerable advantage of that over the years. It allows us to create a number of the extended care projects that we have created, and I'll get to that a little bit later. It's also allowed us recently to develop something called the PATES program, which is a 16-bed facility that instead of sending people to the state hospital, we send them to a non-hospital but highly intensive program. And because of the federal Medicaid match, we can do in those facilities for half the cost what those same patients would get, and probably at a little lesser dollar cost per day in the state hospital. So, in fact, we've been pursuing that very mechanism for some time.
Thank you.
All right. We reopened, the goal was to reopen to voluntary admissions at the state hospital. The goal was to serve 4,000 to 5,000 individuals in acute care hospitals per year. Another goal was to reduce acute care stays from the average of 40 in the acute care units of the state hospital to around 10 days in the community-based programs. And finally, there was a goal set of enrolling 1,000 new individuals in outpatient care. My interpretation of the 1,000 new individuals was that they were thinking primarily in this commission of adults with serious and persistent mental illness, and we'll get to the increase a little bit later. It's considerably more than that. All right, what happened? One reason I'm walking you through this is that this is actually a report that has been largely adopted. It's really served as the blueprint over the last dozen or more years of the work that we've done in the state office. And so I think you'll find that a number of things that were set as goals were in actuality were accomplished, in some cases more than that, and in some cases less than that. Planning, my belief is that we can still continue to do mostly ad hoc crisis planning in this state around mental health services. We're pretty opportunistic, and when opportunities come to develop a PATES program and take advantage of the Medicaid match, we've gone after those things. We did have House Bill 3024 passed by the 2001 legislature. The budget cuts have created some difficulties with the actual planning process, but we are moving forward with that, and we will have a statewide plan available for review by the legislature in another month or two. State hospital improvements. I think here we've seen some real improvements in the care of patients in the state hospitals. Particularly, there's now an opportunity for the hospitals to focus on the care of long-term patients and those with specialized needs, such as geropsychiatric patients, people, you know, with various kinds of dementias, head injury patients. We actually have one unit that specializes in younger people who are head injured. It's part of the geropsychiatric unit. We have a high-security forensic unit or two. The state hospital here in Salem is now Joint Commission accredited, and it is CMS or Medicaid certified in its distinct part, which is the adolescent and geropsychiatric units. Move on to the next slide. Local acute care. Probably some of the most dramatic changes in this state have happened in the local communities, where we have at least 15 community hospitals that now admit public patients. We have probably a capacity on any given day of about 200 beds. Sometimes we fill them, sometimes we don't. Most of these beds are purchased on a filled bed basis. They tend to be expensive, much more, about twice as expensive as a state hospital. However, since there's a great deal of Medicaid money available when you do psychiatric admissions for acute care in general and community hospitals, the actual cost to the state is less than it would be if we sent them to the state hospital.
But, Bob, let me stop you right there.
You're saying overall cost that these community care facilities, the 16 or less, 15 or less, are actually more expensive than the state hospital?
Chair Westland, on a daily basis they are, but on a cost, if you look at them on a general fund cost, because Medicaid is often...
I'm talking total funds now.
Yeah, total funds there are more expensive. They're about $750 to $800 a day.
Whoa!
Could I just comment, though, the average length of stay, instead of 30 or 40 days, is now 11.2 days. So what I believe you really need to look at is the cost per episode, and it's considerably less when you look at it that way.
Mr. Chair, I want to make sure I'm clear on what we're talking about here, because this can get a little confusing. community hospitals have developed psychiatric wings, which take acutely, people have acute mental illnesses, and keep them there for a few days to a week or two, and on a daily basis they're more expensive. I don't believe these are the 15 bed units we've been talking about just previously. Those are two different things. Is that correct?
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, that's correct.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Okay. And these people sometimes go on to the state hospital, more commonly go back out to the community as outpatients or treated on an outpatient basis.
Or into one of the 15-bed community
hospitals. Or into one of the 15-bed community hospitals, yes. This is their first intake in the system, usually through an emergency room setting to go to these places.
But those are the folks, to a large part, that churn in and re-represent at the hospital a month later.
There is a fourth way they go, and you are absolutely correct. The fourth place they go is they don't go to a community 15-bed facility. They don't go on to the state hospital. They unfortunately leave here with a note saying go to your community health provider, and if it's not a wraparound system, they go back out the street, and 3 or 4 weeks later, they're back in this one in a very expensive setting again. You're right. Thank you for bringing that up.
Follow-up question.
Bob, you said the hospitals reduced stays from 40 to 11 days. Some of these patients would end up in the state hospitals. Some would end up in community hospitals in a psychiatric wing, or they serve a distinct population. In essence, are the local hospitals that much more effective and efficient than the state hospital serving the same patient?
Chair Westland, Mr. Bukovian. Yeah, in my opinion, the state hospital has always had a difficult time doing acute care in a very efficient way. Partly it's because people are removed from their home communities, usually by hundreds of miles sometimes. One of the ideas behind the community psychiatric inpatient hospitals is that if people can stay close to home, stay in brief periods of time, they don't lose their housing, they maintain contact with their families. And in fact, most people are discharged back to their families or back to their own housing. About one out of 20 people who are admitted to the acute care hospitals in the community hospitals, as Representative Bates described, only about one out of 20 of those people actually has to go on to the state hospital. So this has been a very efficient way of keeping people out of long-term care, and it only works, frankly, when there are community resources available to take these people, because you really cannot discharge somebody in 11 days to nothing. And the discharge plans that happen in the local community hospitals require a handoff to a community provider, and in most cases that's the community mental health system.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one last question.
Of course.
Are you aware of the capacity problems involved in this system right now? That commonly in the state, at a given night, you might be, if you're in Medford and you have a psychiatric patient, you need to admit that you have to call, potentially, if your unit's full, you call Klamath Falls, you call Roseburg, you call Eugene, and you sometimes end up patient to patient hundreds of miles away because you haven't got an opening available.
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, yes, I look at those numbers practically every day, and there are times when it's much more cramped, frankly, than others, and there are times when beds are pretty much available. I did look at sometime back when things were the most crowded, and I was surprised to see that the percentage of people who were transferred out of their own local region, in other words, from, say, Medford all the way to Eugene, is relatively small. But the problem is any time it happens, it's a problem because it's very inconvenient, and I think we recognize that. All right, in terms of the numbers of people who are being served in local acute care units, in 2001, 2002, 5,610 different individuals were served in those local acute care units. So I think it's clear we more than exceeded the 4,000 to 5,000 people that we wanted to have served in local acute care back in 1988 when the Governor's Commission report was issued. Voluntary admissions have been reestablished, and the last time I checked, it was accounting for about 40% of the local acute care admissions. And I think from an advocacy human rights standpoint, that's a very positive change. What it means is that no longer do you have to be forced by a court or picked up by a police officer to get an acute psychiatric admission. It'd be nice, frankly, if 100% of our admissions could be arranged that way, but I think that we're a ways off from that.
(Clears throat)
All right. Another of the goals was to increase the range of community services. And since 1992, we've created about 600 new extended and enhanced care placements. Excuse me. Now, these are the facilities that I think Representative Bates was referring to before. These are not community hospitals, and these are not $700 a day beds. The most expensive of these beds is probably $275 a day. That's a secure residential treatment facility. We have six of those around the state. But most of the other beds are considerably less expensive than that. In fact, some of them aren't beds, thank you, at all. They are what we call intensive supported housing case management programs. Those are in the neighborhood of $20 to $30 a day. The reason we have 580 to 600 of these beds now is that as we closed Amish, we began to work very carefully with the community mental health system and asked them if they could come into the state hospital and help us with the targets that were being set as a result of budget cuts and the legislative interest in downsizing the state hospital. So that we asked counties basically to help us identify people from their communities who were in the hospitals. We asked them to go in, tell us what they needed in order to live safely in the community, to cost it out for us. Excuse me. And if we could agree with their clinical assessments and agree with their financing, we would use the monies available through the legislature to fund those projects. So what we really got was the money following the patients. And we did this repeatedly over the last 10 years so that we now have what I consider a kind of a decentralized state hospital system, people who would otherwise be in the state hospital but can live successfully in the community. I often ask people, legislators and others, if they've ever heard of these programs. For the most part, the answer is no. And I submit that one of the reasons for that is that they've been very successful. 95% of the people who've been discharged to these places are able to stay in them. A few people, you know, we see episodes where we have to take them back to the state hospital. But I think on the whole, they've been as successful as anything we've done in the mental health field. And these are programs that took people that a lot of folks thought could not live in the community at all. So I'd be happy to give you more detail on these programs, but I think that we more than exceeded the expectations in that area. We did create something called the Extended Care Management Unit, though, to look after these programs. One of the functions that you lose when you close a state hospital or you downsize is some of the central administrative functions which decide which patients can be best served at which ward or in which level of care. You also can lose utilization review and utilization management functions. So we've recreated those in something that I'm not sure exists anywhere else in the country. It's a 6.5-person team of highly qualified clinical specialists. Most of them have master's degrees, and they screen all of the people who are going to be admitted to the state hospital under civil commitments for long-term care, and they gatekeep this system of 580 beds out there. We've also created a large number of crisis respite, supported employment, and other wraparound services for adults and children and families. The increase in numbers of children served from 89-90 has gone from about 11,000 to almost, a little over 29,000. There were two explanations for that. One is the EPSD, the early periodic screening. I get mixed up on the words, but EPSDT. Federal requirements really infused a lot of Medicaid money into the children's mental health system and really allowed Oregon to expand rapidly during the early 90s and mid-90s. And then, of course, the Oregon Health Plan added a few more, although I think the bulk of the increase took place during the time of EPSDT. And the number of adults served has gone from 28,000 to over 71,000 during that same period of time. As I mentioned, Oregon Health Plan has been a major factor in increasing the outpatient and inpatient access. The estimate of unserved adults, for example, has decreased from 50% in 1988 to about 20% this past year. These are adults with serious and persistent mental illnesses. I think it's critical that we try to serve all of these people at some point because they're all at risk of hospitalization, and ultimately, if we don't look after their needs. I think as Dr. Hawthorne pointed out in the 1870s, the earlier you begin to intervene in major mental illnesses, the better the outcomes are going to be down the road. And frankly, the less expense there will be to the state in the long run. And I mentioned the children's EPSDT factor. Just quickly, I wanted to mention a couple of changes that have been happening in the 80s and 90s. NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, promoted something called community support projects, which was really an attempt to get away from providing outpatient individual therapy to people with schizophrenia, because it's been fairly well known for a long time that that's not very effective. There's a place for counseling, there's a place for outpatient therapy, there's a place for psychotherapy, but generally it is not very useful in serving people with the major mental illnesses. Once they're stabilized, there may be some issues that need to be worked through, but because we now know that these are at heart, biologically based disorders, they respond very well in most cases to medications, and they respond very well to case management and outreach. Those are the kinds of things that we need to be emphasizing. And NIMH was wise enough to see that in the early 80s. Oregon had one of the first community support projects, and we developed a number of those kind of programs around the state. In the 80s and 90s, we began to notice the impact of alcohol and drug abuse by persons with mental illness. And I won't go into that in detail right now, but just suffice it to say that probably half of people with major mental illnesses are struggling with alcohol and drug problems. It may not be classic addiction, but it's the kind of thing where any use really aggravates a lot of their symptoms. A little bit of use sometimes helps few of the symptoms, and it's a very easy trap for mentally ill people to find themselves falling into, is to start using and then find that it's really not helping them stay in control of their life. Costs of housing are a key factor in the treatment of mental illnesses, particularly of major mental illnesses, because if you don't have a safe, secure, affordable place for someone to go, it's very hard for them to maintain their stability, even if you have them on the proper medications. So homelessness and incarceration are emerging issues, really not emerging new, but we certainly have not solved them all. Let's go to the next slide. In the area of forensic beds, instead of adding 168 forensic beds by 1995, we've actually added only a balance of about 44 beds. We did close four Department of Corrections forensic wards. At least one of these was a sex offender treatment unit that went back to the Department of Corrections a couple of biennia ago, and there are a couple of other programs that have since been closed.
When did we do that, Bob?
Close. Well, I'm trying to, Chair Westland, I believe it was two biennia ago, but I would have to go back and double-check that.
Close enough.
Oregon State Hospital also opened one new psychiatric security review board, forensic ward, and one 370 forensic ward. The 370s are the treat until fit ward. They're criminal commitments, but people are awaiting trial, and they are in treatment under order from the court until such time as they're able to aid and assist in their own defense. I think one of the areas where we have probably the most mixed success from this commission report was in the area of reconstructing and remodeling the state hospitals. We did remodel the 50 building. There was a wall that was poorly constructed. We had to go back in and basically reconstruct it. That was done about 5 or 6 years ago. As you all know, we closed the Amish State Hospital in 1995. We leased a 68-bed modern hospital in Portland to in part replace it, and we also sent about 70 patients down here to Oregon State Hospital. And the other people were all accounted for in these extended care projects that I mentioned earlier. We also, in the last year, replaced the little children's ward at the state hospital. Kids now 13 and under do not have to go to the state hospital. They go to a facility in Portland that's operated by Trillium.
Bob, do we have any idea how what the dollar figure is in terms of the capital improvements and maintenance lag? But if you could push a magic button.
Chair Westland, I don't know the exact figure. I know that it's in the millions of dollars of deferred maintenance. And
tens of millions?
I would defer to Dr. Mazerhart for an exact answer. It's a large number.
Good.
A couple of things that happened that weren't anticipated by the 1988 report. I've already mentioned the extended care and enhanced care service system. Let me mention another Medicaid option that we've taken advantage of really over the last 5 or 6 years. It's called personal care, and it's different than the Oregon Health Plan, and it's different than the old rehabilitation option. What it allows us to do is put a funding base into our residential programs as long as they're 16 beds and under. we can get Medicaid money into those facilities. And a couple of times when we needed to find some savings, that was one area that I knew that we could, if we needed to do it, go in and convert some general fund in residential programs into Medicaid funding. Now, the problem was there were a few facilities that got left out because they were 16 beds and larger. They were Hoodview, William Elaine, and the Pioneer Guest Home out in eastern Oregon. We now have an administrative resolution to the cuts that we were having to make in those. I'm happy to report that we're able to take care of those folks at this point. But it left a couple of large facilities very vulnerable because all we had to support them with was pure unmatched state general fund. And I believe once we've converted these three facilities, we'll have our entire residential system using Medicaid personal care funds.
Question?
Yes.
Thank you for that. And what is the match?
The match is, Chair Westland, Representative Monis Anderson, the match is the same as for the other Medicaid programs, 40-60 approximately. So it's a very efficient use of state dollars to go that direction. Okay, next slide. Another thing that is, I think has not been well known, but the issue of welfare reform allowed the Department of Human Services to use some of those savings to avoid some costs that we would have otherwise incurred. I think one of the unresolved problems over the years has been making sure that we had enough state hospital beds to serve everybody who really needed to be in a long-term care situation. And when we have run into census problems and funding problems, one of the ways to avoid adding a lot more state hospital beds was, frankly, to develop state-of-the-art community-based programs which allow us to use Medicaid and extend our state general fund dollars further. So part of what allowed us to do this at several different rebalancings in the past were some savings that came out of welfare reform. We may not always be able to count on that, but it saved us on a number of occasions. Another thing that's happened recently is we've decided to develop something called post-acute intermediate treatment services, or PATES programs. And again, I alluded to this earlier. It's a $453 a day service, but because we have Medicaid matching funds, it costs the state about $190 a day. These same patients would otherwise have no choice but to go to the state hospital, which is about $393 a day. One of the unique things about this program is that every patient who's admitted has a 30, 60, or 90-day length of stay projected. We do that on the basis of what we think clinically they're going to need in terms of additional medication management, additional stabilization of their psychiatric symptoms, and additional discharge planning. It's a program that, in my opinion, is working exactly like we wanted it to. The average length of stay for all of the folks who are going in there is about 48 days. We have two different sites, one in Eugene and one in Gresham. And I think it's something that we need to be thinking about in the future as a way of manage people who otherwise might have to go to the state hospital. Again, it's a non-hospital level of care, but it's actually more intensively staffed in terms of the number of people who look after folks than you get in the state hospital.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
When people leave those facilities, you only have them in Gresham and Eugene, they go back to their own community. And they drop back into, I would assume, some kind of community care. But knowing that we have a wide range of care in different parts of the state, how do you manage that to occur without them being recycled back into the program again?
That's one, Representative Bates. That's a very good question. First of all, we only place patients who are from the Portland area in the Portland facility, and we place only people from Eugene in the Eugene facility, or from Lane County in the Eugene facility. The reason for that is that the discharge planning has to start the day they walk in the door, and so the county programs are asked, and they've been responding very well to this, to be there and to begin doing the discharge planning with people. And that's the only way this will work. There's nothing magic in the facility. What's magic is its connection to the community mental health system. Multnomah County had really stepped to the plate to help us with the Gresham facility, and we could not have done this without the community mental health programs being there.
That's good.
Right. Thank you, Chair. Bob, how do you just kind of measure the success of a program, you know, having come out of a the field myself, you know, in discharge planning, sometimes those things fall apart or, you know, people, you know, recycle back in. Do you base it on the number of people who don't enter a program again or stay in the community X number of days?
We're looking at all of those. We're looking at, first of all, how long do they stay? What's the recidivism rate? In other words, how soon do they have to be readmitted, either back to that facility or to an acute care hospital or back to the state hospital? We look at satisfaction with the services. We look at community tenure. We look at where they actually went. I've asked our staff to prepare a report on the PATES programs because I really believe that we need to have a strong evaluation component, and we should have that ready for review in the next couple of weeks. I know they're very close to finalizing it. But to quickly answer your question, all of the above, I think we have to look at all of those things. Evidence-based practices. We've known in many cases for 10 or 15 years what we need to be doing. And I think the concept of evidence-based practice has come along in the last year or two in a way that we can actually work with. Oregon is one of seven states that's affiliated on a couple of projects with New Hampshire Dartmouth Psychiatric Research Center. We have several projects that are going, and what we're learning from these projects is what you do to monitor programs to make sure that they convert whatever they've been doing to evidence-based practices. We have fidelity scales which allow us to test whether how close to the research-based practice they are coming. We provide technical assistance to these projects to help bring them up if they're not doing all of the things that would give them an adequate score on their fidelity scale. And the assumption here is that if we can replicate things that research has always already shown to be effective, then we will, by definition, be getting the kind of outcomes that we want to have, and we can demonstrate that. So I think that's a key direction that we have been trying to go, and I certainly hope we have an opportunity to continue in that vein. Finally, I want to mention one project that I don't know if many people have heard of. It's happening here in the mid-Willamette Valley. It's called the EAST Project, Early Assessment Supports and Treatment. And using some Oregon Health Plan money and some private foundation money and some other community mental health program money, the Mid-Valley Behavioral Care Network created a program that takes young people 16 to 25 who are having their first psychotic episode, not just anxiety disorders, but kids who are psychotic. And it provides them state-of-the-art medication approaches, not too much, not too little. It's based on some approaches that have been researched in Australia. They work very intensively with the families. They work very carefully with the young people. They get kids back into school and they get back to working. And it's probably the most remarkable project that I've seen in about 30 years in the business. It's something that a lot of us talked about, I know, 15 or 20 years ago, saying, boy, I wish we could figure out some approach so that when kids have their first severe psychiatric episode, we don't consign them to a life of hospitals, state hospitals, disability, and all of the rest. And I think this is a very exciting program. I truly wish there was one of these kind of programs in every community of the state. I happen to have made a referral of a family friend to this program, so I've been watching this thing play itself out. And the young man is back at community college. He's getting straight A's. After being completely non-functional, he could have very, very easily ended up on a forensic unit. And I think this is a remarkable kind of model that we need to be looking at for the future.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a couple of quick questions here. These types of models that are being developed in the state, what's the cost per bed day compared to the state hospital?
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, the cost is probably less than acute care hospitals. In fact, I'm sure it's far, far less than $700 a day. Some of these kids have had to be hospitalized briefly, but the real cost savings is going to be in the future, in the next couple of years. The costs, though, are not extraordinarily higher than any kind of intensive case management program would be. So I don't believe that the cost to be prohibitive in terms of doing this. But it does take an investment up front of deciding you're going to really focus on some kids early in their episodes and not just giving them, you know, a cursory treatment the first time around.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I was really thinking in the other direction, frankly, of them actually being less expensive. But do you believe or do you have any knowledge that there are people now that we've kept at the state hospital that are on civil admissions that could have been brought or should be brought down to the local community level?
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, we're doing that all the time. The extended care management unit is in the state hospital identifying patients that could be brought to a lesser level of care, and that's where all of the referrals come from for these extended and enhanced care programs. But if you're asking the question, are there people there now who could have been more successfully and efficiently treated if they had had access to something like the East Project, I have no doubt about that.
Well, Mr. Chair, do you have any idea what the cost has done as far as individual patients at the state hospital as their population has shrunk down over the years? Have we seen that as a steady state, or has that cost per individual gone up?
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, I'm not sure I understand your question entirely.
We know, well, Mr. Chair, we know the state hospital is quite expensive to place a patient in for lots of very good reasons sometimes. The size and the number of people there has steadily been decreasing over the years because of programs like yours and others. You already mentioned the forensics has not grown as fast as they thought they would, although they have little control of forensics. I mean, they're placed there by the courts. What has the cost per bed or per patient been doing on a per-day basis at the state hospital? Going up, going down, staying the same?
Chair Westland, Representative Bates, the cost has gone up, and you would expect any kind of medical inflation factor to apply to a state hospital as well as to the hospitals. And so we could get that data for you. You know, it's in my memory, 10 years ago, the cost for a state hospital bed that is now $393 a day was probably around $220 a day. It's in that sort of range where we've seen probably a 50 to 60% rate increase in the last 10 years. But we could get that data for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to see that against general medical inflation and see some idea of what's going on there. Can everyone hear all right in the back? Okay.
All right. All right. Other developments in the 90s. Training programs, in my opinion, have been a little slow to catch up with the research base. We're working now with Portland State University to get one elective course started on evidence-based practices. That's a good start, but I think we need to move as quickly in that direction as we can with our higher education, particularly our publicly supported higher education programs. What we find is that people who come to us are not necessarily trained in the evidence-based practices, and we need to be making, in my opinion, a better effort in that area. Property tax limitation, Measure 5, certainly increased our reliance on federal funds. That was something that wasn't really anticipated in the 1988.
Can we go back to that evidence-based thing for a moment? Who at Portland State is being trained for evidence-based?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlich, we're talking with Vicki Vandiver in the School of Social Work.
So social workers are, but are you doing similar things for psychiatrists in their training program? Issue in other places.
Well, we're talking, but I'm not sure if we have as concrete a direction yet. We're certainly willing to. I think that would be an excellent conversation to have.
Well, there is the evidence-based practice center.
Yeah. Chair Westland, Representative Greenlich, I think that what you're referring to is in the addictions area, maybe more than in mental health, and I think you have an exemplary program, and I've been cross-fertilizing a number of things with what you're doing at your center.
Yeah, probably. No, I'm talking about the question of introducing psychiatrists to the notion of evidence-based practice and use of the evidence-based practice center, for example, that's worked with the health plan to create models on evidence-based review of categories of drugs and things like that. I mean, there is a program. It would seem to me the psychiatrists may need this training more than social workers. That's a comment.
Make a note of that.
Doctors can use it too.
It turns out.
Primary care
doctor.
I want to mention the methamphetamine epidemic and its psychiatric casualties. About 4 or 5% of people who go on to methamphetamines develop chronic psychiatric symptoms. These are often intractable, very difficult to ever make them go away. They do require psychotropic medications. And a couple of years ago, I did a survey in our local acute care community hospitals, and about one out of 20 of our admissions, 5% of them, were methamphetamine psychoses. So it's added another layer of issues to our psychiatric community and reinforces the notion that we need to work very carefully with addictions to help these people. I think everybody's quite aware of the new and expensive medications. I think it's fair to say that a lot of the changes that we've made in the state hospital system probably wouldn't have taken place without those. I've already touched on most of these issues that I've suggested that we need to be paying attention to for the 21st century in Oregon. So I'll just hit them lightly now. More mentally ill people are in jails and prison despite a dramatic increase in access to acute care hospitalization. I think there are a couple of things that we haven't probably looked at enough there. We're arresting a lot more people. People with mental illnesses, by and large, don't make very good criminals. They get caught. They often get caught in the system. And I think, methamphetamine epidemic is another piece of that that probably explains some of it. We need to implement more evidence-based practices. We need to balance needs with budget realities, probably the headline. We need to balance needs for public safety and civil rights. We need to achieve more cost-effective methods for long-term care. We need to respond to changing Oregon demographics, particularly the number of Hispanic people who are here now, and we need to become more adept at providing bilingual, bicultural, mental health, and addiction services. And we always need to work on improving state, county, and regional coordination.
Representative March.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The mentally ill in the jails and prisons, I mean, the acute hospitalization on the short term, and running people through the involuntary commitment process is one layer. But the persistent problem I've heard from my sheriff is that they've got people, state hospital doesn't have beds. And so to the extent that are we still running 40% voluntary admissions to the state hospital? Was that what you'd said earlier? And
Chair Westland, Representative March. No, what I meant to say was that in our local acute care hospitals, 40% of those admissions are voluntary. Virtually 100% of admissions to the state hospital are either civil or criminal court commitments.
Okay. We need beds, basically. I mean, we're losing patients in the hospitals, and in the jails very rapidly.
Chair. Representative Greenlick.
Bob, hi. Can you talk about A&D services after?
In a little bit.
Okay. I'm trying to track the question of how the relationship between the block grants, let's talk just about mental health now, and the Oregon Health Plan, and your boss, Dr. Cass, has reminded me very strongly that no mental health block grant funds are intermingled with the Oregon Health Plan. But maybe you could tell me how about $4.5 million a year in block grants that's distributed various places but mostly through the counties relates in the provision of services to the Oregon Health Plan piece of mental health services. How do those two things?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, Barry Cast is correct in that we don't mingle the mental health block grant funds with Oregon Health Plan services. In fact, now the only money that we have left in the budget for serving people who are not Medicaid eligible, either for adults, are the federal block grant monies. Those monies, the $4 million a year, are distributed on an allocation formula to the counties, so each county gets a little share of that. We also have about $500,000 in special block grant projects, and some of those are serving people who are trying to get out of local jails with mental illnesses. Some of them are serving juveniles in the juvenile justice system, and we have a couple of other specialized projects that those federal block grant dollars go to. But they're not being intermingled with Oregon Health Plan dollars.
If I may follow up on that. We'll talk again about A&D block grants, but the question is how do they integrate with services? Are you saying that the block grants are used only for people who are not Medicaid eligible, and there's a a different system for people who are Medicaid eligible that's not relating to that system?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlake, the system is essentially the same. In other words, the same group of providers, and they have braided funding. And what they use the Oregon Health Plan dollars for is for the Oregon Health Plan benefit and what they for Medicaid-eligible people. And then when someone comes through the door who does not have Medicaid, is not Oregon Health Plan eligible, then they have a limited amount of funds to do some of the same kinds of things with the block grant monies for mental health. So it goes into our service elements for outpatient mental health services.
And if I may ask one more question. When Multnomah County just announced they've given up, they've handed mental health services back to the state, does that relate to the block grant, or does that relate to OHP mental health carve out or carve in, or what does that mean when the county says we wash our hands of it?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlake, we have been provided with a 30-day notice for the Verity Medicaid managed care contract, not for the local mental health authority or for the federal block grant monies from Multnomah County. We're also being told that they may be rescinding that, and we're waiting to hear.
Thank you, sir.
Could you flesh that out a little bit, the implications for the system?
Chair Westland, the question would be the implications of the managed care contract being given back to the state. Well, the implications are they're complicated, but in essence, they can be described as putting, at least for the time being, the 60 or 70,000 people who have a Medicaid benefit for mental health under OHP Plus back into a Medicaid fee-for-service system. For the outpatient providers, that means that they can go back and bill the same way they bill on open card Medicaid people now. In other words, there's a series of fee-for-service categories, and they can go and they can bill for those things. The risk over a period of time is that the fee-for-service systems are largely believed to be unmanageable, and we're very interested in what we can do if we're going to go into fee-for-service for outpatient care to figure out a way that we can preserve very good things that have been happening in the service system in Multnomah County, but do it under a fee-for-service system, and we have some ideas about that. We're meeting tomorrow morning, actually, with the executive director of the largest adult outpatient provider, Cascadia, to talk about that very thing. On the inpatient side, what it means to go to fee-for-service is something different. That means that they will be going into a DRG payment system, which is of great concern. We met with them already last week in the Portland area. There are five hospitals, roughly, that do quite a bit of the Medicaid inpatient business, and they're very concerned. They've agreed to meet with us on Friday of this week in conjunction with Cascadia to see what we can do in terms of a creative approach to that. But it doesn't play out very well financially for the acute care community hospitals.
Fair enough. Please continue.
All right. You know, let's skip over this one. I want to go to the colored charts that you have as handouts, because I think it would help answer some of the questions that Representative Greenlake was raising. So I'll have to pop okay, I'm going to show you what we had in 1985, just as a comparison. This is prior to the Governor's Commission. We had largely a general fund supported system. The legend is on the right. So OHP Medicaid, the bright green, doesn't exist yet, so there are no green shades there. Other Medicaid was basically the fee-for-service system, which we now call open card. State general fund, which is the light blue, and then there was federal only. So in 1985, we had a system that was a little bit Medicaid fee-for-service, and in that top layer, we have adult services, day treatment, children's services, and crisis services. I put this presentation together in a hurry, and the crisis respite did not exist. So strike that from your chart. That long yellow strip that says crisis respite really wasn't there. All we had was regular residential, and we had about 400 beds, and we had a state hospital system, and there is an error in the 900. That should be 560 instead of 900. But what I wanted to show you was we had a very if you like simplicity, this was a simple system. It wasn't very functional. It didn't match patients' needs with the level of care that they would get. Now I want to flash forward tonight to our current situation. This is much more complicated. We have mental health organizations with the Oregon Health Plan, Medicaid dollars, bright green. We have county mental health programs with general fund. And now you can see what it looks like with our Oregon Health Plan. I put on the left side physical health care and meds. Hold it just a little bit now, Frank. The physical health care and meds are with fully capitated health plans, so that's not under the Medicaid mental health managed care carve-out. But I wanted to show it because part of the goal here is to integrate physical health care and mental health care and chemical dependency care. We had OHP standard. Obviously, that's out of the picture at this point, but a month ago, we still had that. We had open card people billing fee-for-service. And then we had state general funds supporting adult services, children's services, and crisis services. And I put a little pink there to illustrate the little bit of federal mental health services block grant money that's in the adult, children's, and crisis services.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Where you have the physical health care meds on the left-hand side, is this what we refer to as medically needy?
Chair Westland, Representative Merkley, no, that the people who buy into the medically needy program, they'll do buy into that bright green strip, and they then become eligible for those kinds of services. But that's the physical health care, really, in terms of the dollar amounts, I should have drawn it much larger. That's the Oregon Health Plan, fully capitated health plans dollars. That's a lot of money there. That's probably 8-10 times the size of the mental health carve-out.
Representative Greenlee.
Could you put some numbers on this in terms of mental health services, which just really rough numbers on how these different blocks, I mean, for example, all the federal is $500,000, right? I mean, 500, $4.5 million. How much is in the rest of this?
Okay. Chair Westland, Representative Greenlee. The $4 million of federal block grant in mental health is actually a very small portion. I'm just guessing that it's probably less than 10% of that, of the just the blue shaded area there. It's a very small portion of that. Now, with the cuts we've had to make, it's about the only thing that's left, as I mentioned, for adults. And with the restoration of the children's general fund, it's a portion of that, maybe 10 or 20%. I can get the numbers for you.
Just rough. That blue box you said was 10% federal and 90% general fund?
I think that's a pretty close.
Would that be about guess. $40 million of general funds, roughly?
I would want to go back and double check that, but roughly.
We had those numbers. And all those yellow things? How much?
The yellow things, other card, other Medicaid or open card, people who for one reason or another are not enrolled in managed care, and they bill an open card. For example, there are people out under the conditional release granted them by the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and they bill on an open card. We took them out of managed care because we didn't want managed care to be a complicating factor in the primary functions that the PSRB is concerned about, and that is public safety.
But how about those other yellows?
Let's go on, and I'll show you some other yellows here. Crisis respite is largely funded with other Medicaid, though there are some carve-out dollars there. The arrow that I just showed you, stop for just a second, Frank. The arrow going into the acute care hospital section should actually extend into the OHP Plus box. There was a glitch in the program here, but one of the things that's different about the Oregon Health Plan mental health carve-out is that it's actually responsible for the acute care psychiatric episode. therein lies an incentive to try to provide preventive care to prevent people from having to go to an acute care hospital. Once they go to the acute care hospital, then it's the managed care plan that has to pay for the acute care hospitalization. And about 60 to 70% of the 200 beds that we buy are purchased through the Oregon Health Plan, OHP Plus. So it's a major funding source now for the community acute care hospitals. Excuse me. We have regular residential beds, and again, it's now shaded with Medicaid because of the personal care option that I told you about before. The next layer, we have the extended care projects. There are about 340 slots for adults, 141 for older people, and children's intensive treatment services are things like psychiatric day treatment for kids and psychiatric inpatient or non-residential care for kids. Actually, there is a chunk of Oregon Health Plan Medicaid money in there, so I probably need to do a little bit of revision. And then finally, show the state hospital slide. State hospitals have a little bit of Medicaid money in them, other Medicaid, but they're almost entirely state general fund. And finally, we have a federal PATH block grant, not a block grant, but a PATH grant for serving homeless mentally ill people, and that's only available in two counties, Multnomah and Marion. These are only rough, in roughly equivalent in terms of their sizes, but I thought it would be helpful to try to show in one picture how this community and state hospital system is put together and a rough idea of the funding sources. I also finally just want to comment that we have, as I mentioned, there's a little bit of pink up in the jails and prisons because we've been able to use some federal mental health block grant money to do a couple of special projects there. But as you know, jails and prisons and juvenile justice institutions are also excluded from Medicaid. So once people get incarcerated, well, all we have to rely on to serve them with mental health dollars is that limited pale blue set of colors up there in the very top right-hand corner.
Mr. Bukogian.
Thank you, Chair. And that was one of my questions, Bob. I know there's, I think, a project at one time where there was almost immediate application and renewal of OHP for folks coming out of jail and prison. It was a pilot project that Oregon was involved in. Is this still occurring? Can you give us an update on that project?
Chair Westland, Mr. Bukobian, that project got dealt a very serious blow by the changes in eligibility. The delay in eligibility for the Oregon Health Plan now delays eligibility for those people so that you can't even, if you wanted to right now, because of our budget cutbacks, we can't make them Medicaid eligible the day they walk out of jail. There's a, you know, a 30 to 45 day delay in eligibility. So that didn't, we you're right that we had that project going, and I think it was moving along successfully as a pilot. And I had hoped that we could translate that into the local jails as well, because the principles should have applied there as well as the state prisons. But again, the budget cutbacks really created some problems in some of the coordination of services that we would like to provide out there. I wanted to comment that there are varying levels of gatekeeping that happen between these. I mean, I think one of the natural questions would be, who decides who gets which level of care? And the basic answer is that for the extended care projects and the enhanced care projects and the state hospitals, that's either a court decision or it's an extended care management unit decision, in other words, an Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services decision, in collaboration with the counties. The counties do their own gatekeeping of the regular residential beds. They do their own gatekeeping of who gets into the acute care hospitals. Sometimes that's the managed care organization that does that gatekeeping. They do their own gatekeeping for the employment supports, and then they provide the services in the top layer there. All right. I would like to just talk for just a few minutes now, and hopefully in conclusion here, about cost drivers. Mr. Bukobian and I talked last week, and he thought it would be helpful if I would give some thoughts on what does drive costs for mental health and to some degree chemical dependency care. I decided to divide it up into five different categories. Demographics. Let's go to the demographics slide. I'm thinking, by the way, here of cost drivers in a pretty general sense. In other words, what what is likely to create the need for more mental health problems or to make their treatment more expensive? So the most basic things are things like population growth, and as you all know, we've had over 20% increase in our population in the last decade or so. So that certainly is one of the drivers. Other drivers are prevalence rates, and these are very rough estimates, but schizophrenia affects about 1% of us in a lifetime. Bipolar disorder is a little bit larger group lifetime, 2 to 3%. Major depression, 5% lifetime. Other ways of talking about diagnoses can lead to much larger estimates, but these are the major mental illnesses. These are the things that the public mental health system probably is going to need to be the most accountable for the most number of years for. Onset, particularly in schizophrenia, is usually late adolescence to early adulthood. Bipolar disorder, there are two major places there where onset can occur. One is usually a little bit later in early adulthood, although it can occur in children. And there's another high incidence of first occurrence of manic episodes in midlife around 40 to 45 or 50 years old. And people with major depression have about a 15% chance of later developing bipolar disorder. Okay, next slide. There are environmental things that drive the cost of mental health services. The availability of toxic substances, alcohol, marijuana, and methamphetamines are the key culprits right now. Not that other drugs can't do that. Ecstasy, heroin, other kinds of things. Exposure to abuse, physical, sexual, verbal, and neglect can also lead to psychiatric problems. I don't believe that there's any evidence that they cause schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, but they can certainly and are aggravating factors and make the treatment that much more difficult. Another environmental issue that drives costs of mental health care is lack of affordable, safe housing. Let's go to the next one. There are social factors, arrest rates.
Excuse me, yes. Bob, Representative Murphy.
Could you expand on that interaction between the ability of affordable, safe housing and the cost?
Chair Wesselin, Representative Merkley. As I mentioned before, it's very hard to provide efficient mental health treatment when a person is living on the street or when their housing is in such a dangerous neighborhood that they can't feel safe when they go home at night. And in fact, since many people with major mental illnesses are living below the poverty lines and there isn't enough federal housing subsidy to go around, many people are struggling with that housing issue. And so it's very destabilizing to live in substandard housing or to be at threat of being evicted. In fact, a lot of times hospitalization gets used, I think, inappropriately when it's really a housing crisis. So that's one of the things that we really try to do is to develop other kinds of housing resources so that people don't have to go to a hospital in order to get a roof over their head.
So, for example,
pull your mic up if you're going to talk.
So, for example, if someone, because they're poor and because they're perhaps evicted, they're moving from apartment to apartment, it's much continuity of care gets broken up, and then without continuity of care, the disease might well get worse. They might there, as it gets worse, they're more likely to get evicted. So it's kind of the interplay that we're talking about here?
Sure, stability factor. I think that's exactly right. And you know, since many mental illnesses are pretty sensitive to stress levels, too, when you're having housing instability, major stressor. Mm-hmm. And
yes.
So I think what you're pointing out is very accurate.
Thank you.
All right. Since mentally ill people do get arrested, just arrest rates themselves, if they go up, you're going to see an increase in the number of people with mental illnesses coming to the attention of the system. And their treatment needs may then present themselves sooner rather than later. Conviction, same kind of thing. Civil commitment rates. The civil commitment rate in this state has been very stable for many years. We can get you more data on that, but essentially we commit about 1,000 people a year on civil commitments, and it's gone up from about 900 5, 6 years ago to about 1,000, but it just kind of hovers around that. In part, it may be a function of a ceiling that's an artificial ceiling, and that we have a certain number of acute care beds, and maybe that's an explanation for why it doesn't ever rise above that. I mean, there are lots of interesting things that we could talk about there. Huh. If we pass legislation, not that I'm recommending that, but if we pass legislation that made it easier to civilly commit people, we would see a rise in the number of people coming to our attention in that way.
some people argue that if we would do that and get them in treatment sooner, maybe the long-term costs would go down. I think those are all interesting arguments to talk about. We have guilty except for insanity pleas, which lead into the Psychiatric Security Review Board system. And I added stigmatization of mental illness as an additional social factor. I wasn't sure really where it went, but I think because this is a stigmatized illness, people wait a long time sometimes to recognize that they have a mental health problem and wait too long to get treatment, which is why a project like the EAST Project is so valuable in that it tries to really destigmatize things, tries to intervene early, treat people with their families, et cetera, et cetera. Fourth area is treatment, cost of pharmaceuticals. I don't think that needs a lot of belaboring, but the cost of pharmaceuticals has gone up extremely high. Medical and social service inflation are always those factors that get built into things. And hospitalization itself, to the degree we over-rely on hospitalization, to that degree we also raise the costs, and that becomes a cost driver in and of itself. To the degree we find safe ways to avoid hospitalizing people, we can lower costs.
Mr. Bob? Chair?
Representative or Mr. Bukowski.
Thank you, Chair. Bob, there's been some research and discussion about decrease in certain, for example, hospital costs when you increase in pharmaceuticals, especially maybe in psychiatric. Have we ever looked at maybe internally dollars that maybe have been saved in certain areas of our system when we, for example, used? Is there an offset? That a noticeable offset.
Chair Wessel and Mr. Bukowian, I'm not aware that we've looked at that recently in terms of the acute care hospitals. I know that we looked at that sum, although I don't know how systematically, at the closure of Damish and the degree which the medications that were coming along at that time, Clozaril and other medications, were a key factor in allowing some people to be stabilized enough that we could consider placing them outside of a state institution. I can check to see if we can resurrect any of that.
Representative Greenland.
I notice you don't mention NAMI's favorite, the parity with mental health and A&D services and insurance as an issue here. Do you think that factors into this?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlick, no, I didn't mention it, and I'm not real clear on how it would really affect the public mental health system. I think that there would be some savings in the public mental health system, but when we're not serving everybody who needs services anyway, I'm not sure that there wouldn't be just a backfilling of people whose needs then could be met because their private health insurance did a better job of covering them. They wouldn't have to come to the public mental health system as quickly. Okay, some systems issues. And here I'm going to talk about some things that I think the system could work on. Not all of these, maybe, but I think some of these are things that we need to be approaching. Prescribing practices themselves, such as polypharmacy. Polypharmacy means prescribing a lot of different of the same medication to the same patient. And what we're finding, for example, with the newer atypical antipsychotics is that it doesn't enhance effectiveness to have a person on more than one of the atypical antipsychotics at a time. So to the degree we can work with doctors around their prescribing practices, we might be able to reduce one of the cost drivers, which is, in my opinion, polypharmacy. I've mentioned before, to the degree we stay with ineffective treatments rather than evidence-based practices, we're driving costs up unnecessarily, whereas if we would provide evidence-based practices, we know that we're going to get the best bang for our buck at that point. Scarcity of crisis respite and other alternatives to hospitalization are also things that some communities have been able to do more of than others. And I think that's a way to drive down the cost of hospitalization and therefore the cost of mental health services. I've mentioned the reliance on late rather than early intervention. Effective gatekeeping, utilization management practices, I think to the degree we do more of that and do a good job of it, do it in a clinically sophisticated way, we can keep the cost of services down. If we keep people at the wrong levels of care, i.e. the expensive levels of care longer than they need to be there, that's unnecessarily driving up our mental health costs. Similar issue with misaligned incentives. And I put federal exclusions on the use of Medicaid up because that's not an issue, frankly, that the state has any control over at all. But it would be nice if the feds at some point could take a look at that one. And we've talked with them repeatedly, as has NASHBID, the National Association. Okay.
I think that brings me to the end of my prepared remarks, and I'd be happy to field other questions or whatever.
Any questions for Bob? Representative Greenlee.
Yeah. You didn't talk about alcohol and drug as a...
Thank you.
No, an issue.
I didn't. And I chose to focus primarily on the mental health system. The alcohol and drug system, I can say a few words about that. It's much more dependent on the federal block grant. The federal block grant is, I believe, about $30 million a biennium, $15 million a year. And the alcohol and drug system is about one-sixth the size, budget-wise, as the mental health system. So you can see proportionately in the alcohol and drug treatment field, the federal block grant is a much bigger driver of what we do. And frankly, we're at much greater risk if we don't take care of our maintenance of effort issues. We're going to be asking for a waiver now, as I understand a lot of other states are. But with the cuts we've had to take in outpatient and residential care, we do have some concerns, and we do not want to lose the federal block grant. 20%, as you know, of the federal alcohol and drug block grant has to go to prevention services, and the remainder goes for other treatment services. There are some targets for those IV drug users and pregnant women, I believe, are the other priority populations.
Yeah, if I can follow up on that. That's the elusive block grant I was interested in, and I'm particularly interested in it because it is really important that we don't lose that as we move things around. And I was particularly interested in an agreement between OMAP and OMHAS, what do you call yourself?
That's good enough.
OMHAS. Use OMHAS state funds are used as a state match, and then OMAP makes transfer payments to OMHAS for the amount of the federal match, and that's as a way of funding residential or inpatient services that might not otherwise be funded. Can you talk a little bit about that agreement between OMAP and OMHAS?
Chair Westland, Representative Greenlee, I would like to, but frankly, I do not know any detail about that, but I will go back and get some information for you on that.
And Mr. Chair, that's $30 million we're talking about in that block grant, and we really want to make sure we keep an eye on that ball.
Speaking for the chair, I would agree with that, Representative. Mm-hmm.
I've never sounded so good. Any other questions, Representative March?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, you mentioned the civil commitment issue, and I know it's been a particular interest of mine, and we have a pretty high bar here in Oregon. If I recall, it's something to the effect of the imminent threat to self or others as the sort of the judging bar. And it's meant that some people wind up, if they're like sort of starving themselves to death because they're not eating food, they're not quite imminent yet. So would you maybe talk a little more about that?
Chair Westland, Representative March, that's an area that gets attention every legislative session. I certainly have been a veteran of testifying on a number of the bills that have come up other sessions, and we'll be there again this time. What you, I'm sure, will find and probably have seen is this balancing between civil rights, civil liberties, and the need to protect. And I think it's been very hard in this state, as in most other states, to move that bar one direction or the other very far. It takes a huge amount of effort. One of the problems, I think, in my experience, is that it really gets played out differently in different locales. And there are communities in which a starving, mentally ill person who's eating out of the dumpster will be civilly committed. And there are other communities where judges see that differently. Case law does seem to be moving more toward the imminent standard. But as far as I know, in the statute itself, that's it. You know, it says dangerous to self, others, or unable to care, meet basic needs as a result of the mental illness. So a lot of this really comes down to, I think, resources and the views of judges in local communities and the aggressiveness with which defense counsel pursues the evidence that gets presented, et cetera, et cetera. I'm probably not asking for my opinion right now, but just to give it to you, I think it's very hard to move that line very far. To the degree you begin to move it and make it easier to civilly commit people, there are costs to the state. And in this kind of environment, I think that's going to be a very hard argument to make. And it's very hard for the advocates, NAMI and others, to definitively show that there would be cost savings if you did that. And not to say that there wouldn't be, but I think it's been very hard to prove that. So I think the argument gets grounded at that point a lot of times.
Representative Cruz.
Yeah, and NAMI's been on both sides of that issue. Is there a disconnect in the civil commitment arena between adults and juveniles?
Chair Westland, Representative Cruz, children can be civilly committed under the same laws, under ORS 426, as adults can be, but because they have guardians, i.e. their parents or the state or the or OYA, if they need treatment virtually all of the time, that's how they get it. There have been a few cases, and I've worked on a couple of these in the last couple of years, where the parents, the legal guardians, for some reason, refused to allow the kid to be admitted to an acute inpatient hospital. And there have been times when a county has pursued the civil commitment route to save the kid's life. At least that was their view of it. But basically, you don't have to use civil commitment with children. But if you did, it's the same set of standards.
Okay, and I guess, and we know, Ms. Chair, that we have a lot of people with mental health problems in our prison system. But I had a meeting earlier with Karen Brazeau and was talking about the fact that they've got 25 diagnosed schizophrenics in OIA, and when we're dealing with young people like that still have their whole life ahead of them, I think that becomes problematic. And we were talking about what we could do about it at this point in time. Probably not a whole lot, but except maybe try to keep future kids out of that system. But I mean, that becomes problematic when somebody when a youth gets sentenced, when civil commitment might be an option, and I'm just kind of trying to figure out if there's, because it is a different dynamic because they're kids, for one thing, and it'd be interesting to find out if there's some way we could kind of reverse that, and because clearly if we have somebody that absolutely is diagnosed, that has to be the first place we need to deal with is their diagnosed mental illness rather than what they are doing behind that mental illness. So that wasn't a question. Thank you.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it's a question.
Certainly a problem.
I'm sure that glad that wasn't the chair speaking. That's all I can say about it. Mr. Bukovian.
Thank you, Chair. Bob, I'm not sure if you can objectively answer this question, and don't know if you can't. Just reading, it seems like each state is struggling with a mental health system. Is there one besides Oregon that you think is really a standout state in terms of a state community mental health system? And if so, just generally why they might stand out better than the rest?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bukovian, I think most state systems are struggling right now, so any knowledge that I have may be already outdated. The state that I've looked at over time the most has been Ohio. Ohio has a very activist, well-known state mental health commissioner by the name of Mike Hogan. He happens to have been appointed by President Bush to chair the President's New Freedom Commission on Mental Health. I've talked with him, and there are a number of unique factors that happened in Ohio a number of years ago that allowed them to develop a very strong mental health system. But I think there are some other states that have developed creative approaches.
New York 20 years ago.
Follow up on that. What's unique about, I mean, is there one or two? one or two things unique about Ohio's approach that...
Chair Westland, Representative Cruz. One of the things that's unique there is that they created local regional boards that had taxing authority. So there is variation in Ohio between the level of care you might get, but it's often a function of the degree to which a local community wants to support its mental health program. So that's one of the features. I also
you can do.
I agree.
I would also add that Oregon has not had a bad mental health system, in my opinion. You're saying that I might have some biases. In comparing our access to a state like California, we've not done a bad job of getting people into mental health services, particularly in the last 10 years. We've also reduced our state hospital population to a point where there's a fairly good balance, not that we have all the problems solved, but there's a reasonably good balance between community care and state hospital care. We've done probably more in the way of creating this middle tier of services for extended and enhanced care than pretty much any other state. I think we've done a good job of gatekeeping it, making sure the programs continue to serve people who are really high level of need but don't need to be in the state hospital if they can be served there. So I think that we've done a number of things. I think we've obviously we've created a tremendous increase in the number of kids and adults who have gotten access to mental health services in this state in the last 10 years.
Well, we have a very important guest here who has a very important obligation at 6 o'clock. We're not mentioning any names or looking at anybody, and unless that individual is going to Kansas to participate in that function in person, I think you're in pretty good shape for getting there, Bob. And we want to
thank you, Mr. Chair,
for coming. I particularly enjoyed the historical perspective and the one bullet point on your slide that indicated that in 1877, was it? Yeah, 1877, we spent 52% of our state budget on mental health issues. I mean, that's incredible.
Marvelous.
All the people that came to Oregon instead of going to California.
Yeah. Yeah. We had all the quick get rich guys go to California, you know, foundation of our country. And then, you know, those farmers' crews came to Oregon. Obviously, a much sicker population.
Well, there is something to say.
We were repressed. Selecting for adverse risk, right, you know, from the get-go. The,
Mr. Chair, I would say is even in this day and age, somebody who thinks they can make a living farming.
That's where I was going.
Yeah, without getting rich being a state legislature.
Anyway, I appreciate very much you coming. This is very helpful to the committee in the big picture overview. Bob. Thank you. Any other business come before the committee? Seeing none, we are adjourned.